Since the inception of the Congressional Task Force on Declassification of Federal Secrets, the JFK Records Act has been top of mind. Given that the act has essentially been disregarded and not followed, it was a seeming victory for truth when President Trump declassified many of the remaining withheld documents in 2025. However, the exact status of the JFK records remains murky. In this episode, I'm joined once again by two of my co-authors on the JFK assassination chokeholds, attorneys Mark Adamczyk and Andrew Eiler. But first, I want to make a quick program announcement about solving JFK. I started this podcast out of an honest desire to find out what happened in the JFK assassination. That's the same reason we've all read the books and looked at the documents and watched and listened to the podcasts. We all want to know what happened. While there's still work to do on that question, I wanted to take a moment to step back and say thank you to anyone who listens to the podcast or has let anyone else know about it. When I started solving JFK in 2022, I never imagined how successful that it could possibly be. I wouldn't have believed you if you were to tell me that I would soon have the opportunity to be in a major documentary film, JFK What the Doctor Saw, write a book with Jim DiEugenio, Paul Blow, and today's two guests, appear on CNN and other news channels, and be invited to Congress for the first JFK assassination hearings since the 1990s. Also, thanks to listeners like you, episodes of Solving JFK have now been downloaded over 4 million times. I'm very appreciative for this journey, and I realize that all the work I'm doing is built on the efforts of serious researchers who have made all the points that I'm making and we're making now, many years before me. Having said that, this episode will be the last one for a few months. I've been doing a lot of analyzing, writing, and speaking recently, but now it's time for me to do some reading, learning, and outlining. For this last run of season three episodes, I've got to cover some of the most important topics in the case as we look at the potential roles of Cuba, Fidel Castro, the CIA, and the generals. Over the next 4 months or so, I'll be on a research hiatus so that I can do justice to those important topics. Be on the lookout for new episodes of Solving JFK to come back in November. Okay, back to today's episode. Mark and Andrew are lawyers who've spent years analyzing the 1992 JFK Records Act and the binding legal orders that it created. In April, Mark and Andrew published a sweeping three-part article called The War on Oliver Stone's JFK Records Act. In this episode, we're going to walk through that whole story, including two secret CIA memos written 8 months before the Records Act became law, the congressional records that are still sealed today, and the central mystery: what happened to those 27,000 final determinations? And then, because Mark and Andrew just got back from the National Archives at College Park, Maryland, they're going to tell us what they actually found at the archives. Coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Andrew and Mark, welcome back to Solving JFK.
Thanks,
Hey,
Matt.
Matt.
Good to see you.
Great to have both of you guys, and we've been on a lot of Zooms in our lives together. And it's good to be talking about something where you guys are the clear experts, and I'm just going to ask you questions. I like that a lot. It's good. Three attorneys here, two experts in the JFK Records Act.
Two attorneys, one Canadian lawyer.
Oh, that's right. Canadian lawyer, sure. Could you guys quickly just for listeners who this may be the first time of them hearing you, just kind of share your background and sort of what got you into the JFK Records Act, Andrew and then Mark.
Yeah, sure. I've been interested in the case, but really over the last 5 or 6 years, I really focused in on the JFK Records Act, the law, and how the act was complied with. I do a lot of administrative law, and so it's an area that I'm quite familiar with on the Canadian side of the border. A lot of the principles are similar. And so it really interested me, and I've really dug in quite deep into the act, and working with Mark has been fantastic over the years, and with you, Matt. I mean, we've had so many conversations about this over the last few years, especially with chokeholds. But yeah, my area really is the JFK Records Act and what's happened to those records.
Yeah. We're gonna go deep on that for sure. Mark, what about you?
Yeah, similar. I mean, my interest in the case peaked, I think, like many of us, with Oliver Stone's movie JFK in 1991, and we'll talk today about the relevance of the movie to the records and what we've seen over the last 30 years. But I remember in the fall of 2016, the night that Trump somehow won that election. One of the, you know, regardless of your politics aside, I was really thinking he was going to do something about I just had a feeling he would do something different about the status of the JFK records, knowing vaguely that the 2017 deadline was the following year. I hadn't drilled down on the statute yet. And then when that year went by on October 25th, on the evening of 2017, after Trump had tweeted about being excited about the finally releasing all the JFK records, he did an about face and issued wide sweeping delays, which continued into the Biden administration. And when Trump did that, it really sparked my interest as an attorney to figure out what the heck happened and what the statute really does say and what it doesn't say. So that just led to all kinds of work and avenues, and eventually meeting Andrew. It was, just kind of meant to be that we would get together and start looking at it in a different light. I don't know why it took until 5 years ago for two lawyers that have day jobs doing something else to really get into it as much as we have, but we did. And here we are talking about 2026 and still a lot of problems that we have, you know, really started to understand more than ever. And, you know, fortunately, we've been able to break it down into a lengthy article and several before that. And in a way that just basically shows, here's the problems, it's not in compliance, and here's what we think can be done about it.
Yeah, I want to, before we get into the weeds here, just to zoom out big picture. You know, you talk about the JFK assassination with people, and you talk about JFK records. And what a lot of people will say is, what are you even doing? Who even cares? Those have been destroyed, right? They're not going to be around. We don't even know. Or they'll go, hey, there was no conspiracy, right? Those are two very common answers that you'll hear. There's not a whole lot of people who say, let's look at the actual process and see what's there and what actually happened. And that's what I love about what you guys are doing, is that you're tethered to you're literally looking at the emails from ARRB, officials back and forth to one another. And you interviewed some people who were on the ARRB. So what I always find to be interesting is, you know, when you're tied to the documents in this case and you zoom in close, a lot of times you'll find that the official story sort of supports the critic side. And that's kind of, one more time, this whole conversation we're having, I view as just an extension, Andrew, of your obstruction chapter that you wrote for Chokeholds. But
yeah, you know what? Chapter 10 of our book is pretty special in my view. And I got to credit Paul Blow for doing the lion's share of work on that. But the The assassination's fascinating because from day one, anyone who criticized or thought differently than the findings of the Warren report was chastised. They were marginalized by the media. And over the years, whether it's the release of the Zapruder film in 1975 or a lot of the records that the ARRB released in the mid-1990s, I mean, up until that point, the going story was that the Parkland doctors didn't look at JFK's body in trauma room one, and that they weren't qualified to render any opinions on the nature of the president's wounds. And it was the Bethesda autopsy staff that knew the real truth about the nature of his wounds. And then come 1997, 1998, the ARRB released all of the records from the autopsy staff, and a large majority of them concurred. Their views and their depositions and their notes concurred with the Parkland doctors. The media's ignored that, but every step of the way over the last 62, 63 years, new pieces of information have come out. And our focus on the JFK records collection and the law that governs it, it's a current case of non-compliance. And people go, well, all the records, there's no smoking gun, everything's a nothing burger. Well, no, the non-compliance with the act is not a nothing burger. The way the records have been handled in the 30 years since the ARB issued almost 30,000 legal orders that have disappeared is not a nothing burger. If and Mark is gonna do a better job saying this part, but each record had a little court file. It became a little court file based on each individual assassination record. And the fact that they have lost legal orders issued by the ARRB, or they're buried somewhere at the National Archives, and the public haven't seen legal orders in 30 years, should be a deeply problematic problem for the American public and for Congress, who has oversight over these decisions that the ARRB made. So this is a current issue, and the records are really at the center of it.
Yeah, Mark, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean that's well said. I mean, we take the approach that while some might consider one document to be a smoking gun more than the other, we decided in looking at this subject that it really comes down to all the records. Those are going to live forever, whereas the more time that goes on, and we can talk about what differences could have been made if the review board's orders had been followed 15, 20 years ago instead of last year or not at all. But that being said, there, it's when you go to the National Archives and you see in front of you that there's still non-digitized records. I mean, we only 3% of the review board's actual records that we could find at NARA have been digitized, but when you get your hands on the working files and the memoranda between the review board and the agencies, the review board and different attorneys representing those agencies fighting tooth and nail to get every last assassination record up until September 30th, 1998, when all the agencies knew the review board's lights would turn off. When you see that real struggle up till the 11th hour, you just know, like Andrew said, that's the problem in front of us. And whatever records come of it, come of it. But until there's a full inventory of all of them and in an accounting and just locating of the review board's actual work, as Andrew mentioned, we don't know truly what the true records collection is.
Okay, so and we're gonna zoom into a lot of the granular detail here, but just keeping it high level. So if you're someone who's, you're coming to this and you're going, what are you talking about? Trump released everything. There's like a handful of things left, but it's pretty much all released. Is I mean, let's just talk for a little bit about the state of the records generally and kind of what we have. Because there are documents that there are still some that are, redacted that have been released. There are others that don't have RIF numbers. There's a whole issue of ones that were never even looked at by the ARRB, which is a much, much bigger problem. And then there's the timing of when the documents were all handed over. And then there's the question of this 27,000 documents, the final determination forms, and those tell us when exactly the classification should be removed, right? When the item should be declassified and what the basis is for it. But basically, those documents are not readily available. You guys found some, like an archaeologist finding a dinosaur egg, okay? But nobody knows where the rest of them are. And we have proof that they're not being followed. And so people may say, so what? Who cares? I see how that would have been a problem before, but now that everything's been released, why does anyone care? So could you guys kind of help to answer those two things really quick? Just why should we care if we don't have a smoking gun necessarily, that there's a final determination form that there's a specific document for, although it's very likely given just this numbers game. And then, yeah, just the state of where we are substantively for documents.
Maybe Mark, maybe you should start off with covering Trump's executive order from January of last year, because I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding in the public about what that order actually says.
And then if you want to get into the tranches, if you will, and one thing I was thinking of why does it matter is well, let's get into that, because then we can answer Matt's question on the current state of things and what the confusion is. But right, so in January of 2025, Trump put his best foot forward apparently, and did what he said he was going to do in 2017, and issued an executive order. Now, an executive order is not a statute. It's not the JFK Act. It's the president using his office saying, agencies, you need to do this. And the wording of the order is important to look at, because the perception that it was an order for the release and that's been done is just not the case. If you look at it, it says it's time. It's in the public interest for everything to be released. I am hereby ordering the Director of National Intelligence, the Attorney General, and White House Legal Counsel to come up with the plan and present it to me within 15 days as to how the records of the JF, and I believe, Andrew, I'm correct, the RFK and MLK assassination records were addressed in that order. But really, the JFK assassination is the only matter for which there's a public statute, a federal statute that was unanimously passed that outlines the framework of how to get it done so clearly that you really couldn't ask for it to be better. But the problem, Matt, is that no one's seen that plan. And that's something that should be produced, because all we've seen, we can only speculate as to what it says, because we saw a little over 2,500 records released on NARA's website shortly after Trump's order, in no organized fashion, not tied to any index. And it was fascinating, right? Because it made a lot of news, and there were some things such as the Schlesinger memo that were fully declassified. But it's not released. It's not resulted in a final release of all of the assassinations records at the National Archives, because there's still no inventory and index of all of them to tie it back to. Just as we saw in 2017, there's really no, I don't think, any meaningful difference between releases from 2017 up until March 2025, following Trump's order. Trump's order just said it's time to get it done, come up with the plan. But all we've seen from the National Archives is a random number of records, some of them re-released with the same or maybe a fewer set of redactions. But it's just mainly made headlines. Fortunately, the Representative Luna's task force took it forward and had some hearings, and more records were obtained. But it's not what it's made out to be.
Right. Yeah. No, that's certainly true. I remember it was Tulsi Gabbard was supposed to provide a report and recommendations, and we still don't know what report was provided. And oh, by the way, there was the recent, I'm going to use a controversial word, kerfuffle. There was a recent kerfuffle with whether or not the CIA raided Tulsi Gabbard's office. That language was later sort of walked back. But the question sounds like the office had some boxes of JFK records, and then they didn't have the records. So I don't really
Yeah.
know what happened exactly, but Andrew.
Yeah, you know, I talking about kerfuffles, shortly on the heels of that announcement that the CIA quote raided Tulsi Gabbard's office, Senator Rand Paul, who I believe is the chair of the Senate Oversight Committee, or no, is he chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, one of the two. He stated on the record that he has been seeking church committee files, and he says he can't even get church committee files. Church committee was a precursor to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, so it's his committee. He can't even get records out of the legislative archive, supposedly, or out of the CIA regarding the church committees. Notes, records, findings, investigation reports. And it just shows the intransigence of the intelligence agencies to continue, despite this powerful law, the JFK Records Act, to really stymie any effort for the full documented and inventory release of records. So
Right.
I don't know what to say. We're up against a wall.
So in other words, there was a thoughtful process. That process was usurped at every possible turn. And it's just like everything else in the whole case. Everything that you would expect if there was a conspiracy is there. And then so it's like, well, that doesn't mean there definitely was. It's just that literally all the boxes are checked.
If you wanted a plan, you couldn't get a better plan than the JFK Records Act. It laid out an ironclad process for the collection, review, and release of all JFK records. So the concept that they had to come up with a new plan when a federal agency spent 4 years tirelessly attacking this problem with legislation behind it. And Mark will get into some of Judge Thunheim's testimony on May 20th. We both think that was probably the most powerful testimony that that there's been in the last 30, 40, 50 years with regard to the JFK records. And I don't know, Mark, once we get into the nuts and bolts of the article, I hope you tackle that one.
Well, we'll come right back to that. Let's get into the article.
Let's say you have travel coming up, summer vacations or weddings abroad, maybe an international work trip. Imagine arriving actually understanding the language, ordering food confidently in restaurants, connecting with locals, and feeling immersed instead of just visiting. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing random vocabulary lists and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context, the way language is meant to be learned. The Rosetta Stone lessons are easy to fit into your day. They don't take that long. One of my favorite features is True Accent, which helps make sure that you're pronouncing the words correctly based on where you are. For me, I know I've always wanted to go to Italy, and I know that I'll be brushing up on my Italian with Rosetta Stone when I make that trip. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. Learn faster and retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. It's not just English translations, so you're truly learning how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, and then you build to phrases, and eventually you progress into full sentences. So if you're ready to learn a new language this spring, visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey. I do a lot of reading for this show, and last night I had 11 reader read me HSCA testimony in the voice of Burt Reynolds.
I am not joking. 11 reader turns any PDF, doc, or article you upload into stunningly natural audio. And you pick the narrator over 1,000 voices, including a few legends.
When Sir Michael Caine is walking you through the church committee's report, it feels surprisingly fully immersive.
11 Readers also got 200,000 plus audiobooks for $11 a month. So sign up today. Use code PODCAST and your first 2 months are just a dollar.
So you guys kind of, you start out, and this is a three-part series, but one of the things you do is sort of talk about how, you know, Oliver Stone's film was so important, and then it's immediately attacked by critics without ever really, you know, without them even seeing it. For example, the Chicago Tribune guy, and they just generally didn't give it a fair shake at all. But similar to the chokeholds chapter of obstruction, you know, the whole notion of how the story is playing in the media is consistent throughout. It's consistent with the 1967 countering criticism of the Warren Report document, where they talked about you know, conspiracy theories and how they're going to employ their propaganda assets. And then of course there's the November, you know, last year ABC Primetime did a special, Truth and Lies, Who Killed JFK, and they give 3 minutes to Jim DeGenio and Oliver Stone, and then the whole rest of the 2 hours is all official story, folks. So I guess help me understand the context of why that whole thing is important, the media mockingbird side of things, vis-a-vis the Records Act, I guess.
So, you know, when the film, even before the film came out, this is a singularly unique reaction, preemptive attack on a film. I don't think any other film has received this kind of reception by the mainstream media in the history of film. And before the film was even released, a copy of Oliver Stone's screenplay was obtained. Some may say it was, stolen, but it was obtained and it was leaked to the press. And even before the film came out, there were numerous editorial pieces that were put out by George Will, George Lardner. And when the Academy Awards came out, Jack Valenti, who was the president of the Motion Picture Association, he took out a 2-page ad attacking Oliver Stone's film. And really, they were visceral attacks. They weren't substantive attacks on the film. They might pick a tiny piece, but they were attacking Oliver Stone's character, his intentions, his loyalties. They were going after him and the film so hard. And then once the film was released, there were even more attacks in the mainstream media. But the American public showed up for that film. I think we're all, as researchers, we're all children of Oliver Stone's film, JFK. Most of the current crop of assassination researchers are doing it because they saw Oliver Stone's film. And then they started reading books because it was so magnetic and electrifying, that film, that it galvanized the public. And the big thing that came out of the film was the public reaction to the content in that film. And Americans wrote and phoned their senators and congresspeople. And it was such an uproar. Congress passed the JFK Records Act in record time, unanimously passing it. Every member of the Senate and every congressman and woman voted in favor of the JFK Records Act. And that act, again, it required every agency in the government to transmit all of their assassination-related records to the National Archives so that they could then go to the Assassination Records Review Board, which was an agency established by the act, to then review and issue orders to either release or re-review it if a part of a record or a whole record warranted postponement for release under the strict standards of the act. And, you know, what we can see, and Matt, you've mentioned the February 10, 1992 memo. What Mark and I found over the last year is that the agencies were so finely tuned and nervous about the reaction to Oliver Stone's film. They were meeting in the days and weeks after that film was released. They established a task force on how to contend with all the records that they had. What could they do? How could they maintain classification over the JFK assassination records? And they knew that legislation was coming as of February 10, 1992. The film was released in late December 1991. But by February 1992, they had already done an inventory at the CIA of all of their records. And this guy, Ken McDonald, CIA official, he was tasked with coming up with strategies on how to deal with their records. How can we avoid pending litigation? How can we maintain security classification over our records? And he came up with, I think it's like a 13 or 14 page memo, and he laid out a bunch of different contingencies on how they could maintain classification over those records. And one of them was somehow they must have had ESP or something. They, you know, 8 months before the JFK Records Act was passed, they said, hey, maybe if we transfer these records to the National Archives under their current classification, somehow we could avoid it. We can put it in a special secure segregated collection at National Archives. The CIA will even pay to staff the National Archives to review these records and to make sure that they're handled properly. And you know, there were other suggestions, but the very same day that Ken McDonald's memo came out, a second CIA memo came out from the Director of Operations. And it's, you don't know who the author of that memo is, but they said, hell no. Hell no. We are never going to give a third party agency access to our operational files. And that's a hill that we're prepared to die on. And so it's amazing to see the CIA really ramping up its concern and its strategies on how to deal with the coming JFK Records Act.
So were they ultimately successful in sequestering documents to give to NARA prior to the act being in place? Did that strategy ultimately work out?
You know, what ended up happening is the act had a very tiny section in it. Is it section 5D3, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this section basically said that any record that was transferred to the National Archives prior to the passage of the act did not need to go through the Assassination Records Review Board for review. And it didn't need to receive a RIF number. And what the RIF numbers do for your viewers, Matt, the RIF numbers are so that each record can be individually tracked. And we don't know the volume. We're pretty sure that fairly large numbers of records were transferred to the National Archives before the act was passed. That section 5D3 also says, but those records should all be released, basically. So, you know, we can't tell for sure how many records were transferred beforehand, but I think what the CIA did, they then saw the act forming up and as it passed through the different stages of the legislative process, they knew that there was going to be an appeal process for the agencies to contest ARRB decisions. And at that time, the president was George H.W. Bush in his first term. And he had a fairly strong history with the CIA. He was director of the CIA back when the Church Committee was going. And I imagine that they thought that the president would be a bit of a backstop for any of their appeals to ARRB orders to release records. And in, as we know, in 1992, there was an election. George H.W. Bush contested the election against Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton won. And so I think the CIA had an evolving strategy on how to deal with the records. And that kept going. And Mark, maybe you want to address kind of what happened a little bit with Clinton, if that's okay, Matt.
Yeah.
Yeah, just real quick, the collection we're talking about at the moment, and this also applies in a similar fashion to the Church Committee records, but the memos that Andrew mentioned are fascinating. They're linked in our article. I would highly recommend reading the February 10th memo. It actually lays out the inventory of what is called the HSCA sequestered collection. This group of records from the 1978 investigation at the congressional level into the case, which, you know, resulted in an entire report saying there was a probable conspiracy. So it's 64 boxes of highly sensitive CIA records, including a lot of records on Oswald and Mexico City. So this what happened was at the conclusion of the HSCA investigation, the Congress reached an agreement with the CIA to have everything locked away for 50 years. And that was announced, or the public was reminded of that or learned of that at the end of Oliver Stone's film, right? The HSCA records would be locked. So people were freaked out by that and like, what in the world? Why do we have to wait, you know, till 2029 to learn more? So the JFK Records Act, as Andrew's already stated well, destroyed that whole plan that they had to keep everything secret till 2029. It certainly expedited the process, and almost immediately after the film, there was this law in place. So I just want to give a little context. You can actually see the inventory, if you will, of records we're talking about. And speaking of inventories, kind of answers one of your questions in a sense, Matt. How do we know what number of records made it into the archives early to be especially protected? Not until there's an inventory of the sequestered collection as turned over to the National Archives, and when, and in an index showing if it's been released now or not. So that's the only way to truly know. But yeah, what happened with Bill Clinton, as Andrew mentioned, he took a pretty pro ARRB stance. I mean, he did. So the agencies, we think, and I agree with Andrew, you know, they went into the JFK Records Act world and the review board knowing they were going to be independent, knowing that they would have to provide as many records as they could tolerate for independent review. And they didn't know yet what the review board was going to do, if they were going to play along with the agencies and let them defer records until 2017 or maybe longer if they could get away with that. The review board said, hell no. We're going to hold you to the standards of the JFK Records Act unless you give us a heck of a reason that's supported by the law to not release this now. We're going to release it. So agencies were like, oh, this is they're going to actually do their job. Now I got to appeal to President Clinton to overturn the review board. President Clinton didn't overturn a single review board declassification decision. If the review board said this comes out now or in 2006 or in 2017, Clinton said that's fine with me in every case. And so that was another indication to the agencies that the JFK Records Act was going to be a problem. The review board was doing its job. They fought the agency on every single appeal. And so then it turned into what we feel and we've seen li in living and breathing records at the archives as recently as 2 weeks ago, a waiting out strategy. They literally waited out the review board until they were out of money and time.
Yeah, I'm reminded of something that Alan Dulles said during one of the Warren Commission meetings, when someone's asking about will Hoover be honest about whether or not Oswald was an informant? And then Dulles, without of course ever mentioning a CIA role for Oswald, Dulles comes out and says, "Well, even if he was, I'm sure Hoover would just lie about it. He's not going to tell the truth." So, like, in other words. So they were there's this memo that you've uncovered from 1992 after the movie's out, but before the act is live, and they see it coming down the pike, and they're like, "We're not gonna let this happen." And then they're like, "Oh, maybe we can sort of defang it." And then they're like, "Oh, it's happening." And then they're like, "Oh, it's happening," and they're taking themselves seriously, and these silly little citizens think that their law is gonna be a thing. And then they're like, and then so then they have to figure out how to play it, and then at that point. What it becomes just a waiting game. And even Tunheim himself said that he knew they were waiting him out. So what does that look like for the CIA, let's just say, to wait someone out? I mean, would the documents have already been, does that mean that they just didn't provide the documents on the front end? Or like what does that mean? There's just all these outstanding requests that they never responded to? Like where the rubber meets the road, what does that waiting them out look like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Judge Thunheim from his May 20th testimony before Luna's committee last year. One of his other statements, and I listened to it again earlier this week because it's that good. He said many of our specific requests for records they wanted to see went unanswered. And I actually found an example of that that I linked in the article. Judge Thunheim was asking the CIA for assistance with their Mexican government liaison for access to the TELTAP operational records that would have recorded the phone calls of Oswald in Mexico City at the embassies or alleged calls. And they wanted to complete the story on Mexico City. The HSCA did a heck of a job trying to do it. Dan Hardway and Ed Lopez, wrote a 400-page report, and the review board knew that there were still significant questions on that. In fact, the Lopez report, as I just mentioned, wasn't even publicly available when the review board started. They got it declassified, and but Judge Thunheim was looking for more of the records to supplement the Lopez report, those operational files on the TELTAP operations that were run out of the Mexico City station. And couldn't get them. I saw a memo that, where the CIA got the priority request from Thunheim, and they went back to their office and said, "We're going to have to figure out how to respond to this." So that yes, that we know that the waiting out involved, heavy contested hearings with the board, at least on the records they were willing to provide. And then we've also seen a lot of activity in the internal review board records as recently as 2 weeks ago, where they were fighting tooth and nail. I saw a church committee, an inventory A to Z. You name any intelligence officer of interest at the time of the church committee. Now they were investigating the intelligence abuses all the way going back to the Warren Commission, and they had all these kind all transcripts of all their testimony in executive session given to the church committee. 4 or 5 pages in inventory and handwritten notes of the ARB staffers saying, "We got this, still following up on this, haven't heard back on this." And this went all the way up until the review board was done in September 1998.
Yeah, Matt, our last visit on May 18 to 20 to the archives, we just really focused in on ARRB internal records, which are not digitized. And the hope was, for me, my area, I was looking for policies and procedures of the board for the review process and for issuing their final determinations and that kind of information. Mark was there really focusing in on congressional records, how the ARB handle congressional records. And throughout, like all the records that I reviewed of Jeremy Gunn and Mark reviewed, Ron Herron, who was a senior legal counsel for the ARB, were the ARB really only functionally operated between April 95 and the end of September 1998. 94, they were established and they got appointed, but they were really getting like their office building in place and staffing up a brand new agency and developing their policies and procedures. They really started to get into the records only in the late spring of 1995, when their actual review process started. And even back into 1995, they had identified the church committee, the HSCA records as being kind of a hot zone for interest, and we need all of those records. And so you can see, starting in 1995, they start to make requests. And again, a lot of this documentation isn't publicly available. It's not digitized. So Mark and I are reading correspondence after correspondence from 1995, 1996. But in 1997, as they know their mandate is going to come to an end within a year, 97 and 98, they're sending like bi-monthly memos. We still haven't received this. We're following up. This is essential information. You need to give us a response on this. You need to give us access so that we can finish our job. Give us a timetable when you're expecting these things. They don't meet their timetables. Another memo immediately follows. The ARB staff were tenaciously diligent, trying to get these records with the force of the law out of the agencies. And you can just see roadblock after roadblock, delay after delay, really games that are playing. And it got to the point where Judge Thunheim and Jeremy Gunn started to send threat letters to the agencies. If you don't do this, we're just going to release all the records that we have. And they literally would say it in that kind of blunt language, do it or there's going to be serious consequences. And they were also writing to Congress to complain about the rate of release. And so when we talk about an evolving strategy, CIA didn't really know how the act was going to be passed in its final form. But once they saw it, you know, counsel for the CIA, I think his name is John Edinger, he wrote a 1992 memo, and he's like, holy geez, guys, they're going to allow for the public to have judicial review of the ARB's final determinations. And he's writing this in a memo to the director of the CIA. This act has real teeth. We're going to be in court. This isn't FOIA. This is like the JFK Records Act. We're going to be judicially reviewed on the ARB's final determinations. And so this is a whole different animal than we're used to.
Yeah. And so just real quick, back to the church committee and how you're talking about how the ARRB was really making a push for the church committee. Mm-hmm. I read in your article, and I suppose I knew this, but I didn't connect these things together. Arlen Specter was the chair of the Senate committee, the Select Committee on Intelligence, at the time when the ARRB was trying to get the documents. So he's once again in a position to to affect the case. That's really something.
In finalizing the article and looking into that committee more, it's called the SSCI that the ARRB was dealing with on the church committee records, and I wanted to see who they were dealing with. Malcolm Blunt had told me that the review board was struggling with a guy named Charles Battaglia, who was a staffer on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and I looked him up. And he worked for none other than Arlen Specter. Yeah, he was the liaison, if you will. And I found a couple memos in Ron Heron's files that Andrew mentioned. He was working for Jeremy Gunn, and his sole job was to dig down to inventory and get as many church committee records as he could. And he would write to Charles Battaglia saying, here's our latest inventory. You still owe us XYZ 123. And then they would have a call, like a memorandum of the phone call, and Battaglia would say, "Okay, I got to go talk to Senator Spector about this. I saw a few of those." And of
You know,
course,
hey, I gotta say, if Jim were here, what would he say? He would go, "You can't make this stuff
can't
up."
make it up. And I tell you, in all seriousness, the part of the church committee holdings that the review board was bound and determined to get, what they struggled with the most was the Schweiker Hart files, the subcommittee of the church, which, the church committee looked at a lot of different intelligence abuses, but Schweiker and Hart specifically focus on nothing else but the JFK case. There is not a single trace of the Schweiker Hart working files and records at NARA. And I know Malcolm has gone to NARA at least three times asking for assistance with the legislative archives. The review board sent staffers over there for 3 working days towards the end of their term to get, to get the records in the church committee holdings. And it's that was definitely lingering as of the closing of the review board. And until there's a we mentioned the HSCA 50-year rule. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has the same thing. They have a resolution where they re-review their classified documents every 50 years. That could be what Senator Rand Paul is up against right now. They are treating their records under special rules that are inconsistent with the JFK Act.
That's a great point, Mark.
Yeah, good. That's a good point. Something, so not to be a conspiracy theorist here, guys, but I just want to throw out something that came to mind as we're talking about this. So Jeremy Gunn, all right, he's sort of got a very important role, right, in this. And of course, Tonheim has an important role. A lot of people have important roles in the ARRB who would be in a position to influence. I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that any specific person was a CIA asset in any way whatsoever. Here's what I am saying. After having recently studied, KGB spy games, et cetera, it would be really surprising to me if there was something so high stakes and that covered, that was going to impact intelligence agencies so much, and then they would t for them to not have any assets in, on the inside would be surprising, would it not? I'm just speculating. I'm not saying we've seen, I'm just saying, isn't that what they do? Wouldn't we expect them to have someone there? And if so, that would be hard to combat, I guess. I don't know. Have you guys ever thought of that? Like, oh my gosh, the CIA is so powerful. Why didn't they just put someone on the inside and take it down from the inside? That would probably have made it
Well,
go.
I think it's pretty well known there were at least two CIA officials on staff at the ARRB. I was surprised to learn that. Who knows if there were more, but I think it's pretty widely known that two staff people were one was just seconded right out of the CIA. And took a
Openly?
senior position on the ARP. Yeah, I believe it was open. Yeah, I don't want
Huh.
to name any names
I'm just saying, I would expect them to. Like the amount of effort, like the CIA has a document about Mark Lane going to a conference in Brazil one time in the like in the 90s. Like so for them to for there to be something this high stakes and them to not weasel their way onto it, I'd be disappointed in them, honestly. Anyway, just kidding, CIA. Thank you for keeping us safe.
We're all friends.
We're good. So let's talk about final determinations and these final determination forms. That's sort of zooming super tight in. And the reason a final determination matters is that there are still some records out there that are withheld that should be released. And these forms may tell us exactly when they should be released, and if we can get our hands on a form of one that hasn't been released, that's sort of our golden ticket to get an order to get that released. Is that the significance of the final determinations, or am I probably
Yeah,
oversimplifying.
you know, I mean, it may be, it may not be. We don't know. We've only seen probably 900 to 1,000 ARRB final determinations now. When I was at the archives in November 2024, I searched tons of boxes. I found a box and a half containing about 450 final determinations. Again, these are the legal orders by law the ARRB was mandated to issue for each record that it reviewed and granted a postponement of disclosure to an agency who requested that a record or a part of a record not be publicly disclosed. So for each of those, it's a standardized form. And in the form, it has the RIF number, the originating agency, the date of the document, the number of pages of the document. And then, if let's say there's a three-page document and there's eight sections of the doc, separate sections of the document that they want to remain classified, they'll basically redact those sections. The first redaction on page one will be postponement number one. For that postponement, the ARB was required to give a specified reason under Section 6 why that postponement was justified under the law. Same thing, postponement number two on page one, that's postponement two. There had to be a written reason to not disclose that particular section of the document. And so they did that for almost 30,000 documents. So in total, the ARRB issued 27,000 separate legal orders. Some of those legal orders were 15 pages long because something like the Lopez report had almost 400 redactions in it on its first run through. So it was almost a book, the first order or final determination for the Lopez report. But again, we don't know what happened to these legal orders. They were supposed to be published in annual reports every year. By the ARB between 1994 and 1998, the ARB only ended up publishing one annual report. And again, this was mandated by law that the ARB had to issue annual reports, and they didn't. And part of those reports had to be all of the final determinations issued that year.
And what you found when you went in 2024, or the last time you went, was a box of what, like a 900 final determinations?
450.
Or
Yeah.
if it, okay.
Yeah. And I took a fairly well circulated photo now. They were all in a box that was labeled press and public contacts, which really had nothing to do with the contents of that box. So even if you were searching, and you can only search by archival boxes at the archives, there's no possible way you would have found those if you were looking specifically for final determinations.
What period of time were they for from?
That's a great question. The only determinations I've been able to get all the determinations from 1995. 90% of those were consent postponements because they had social security numbers in them, so they couldn't release government employees' social security numbers. So the 1995 final determinations are kind of irrelevant, but I got 450 from 1996, and that's when they were starting to get into some slightly sensitive documents. It was pretty clear. And in those 450, I would probably suggest 70 to 80% of those required that the associated records be released in January of 2006. So the ARB issued an order for each record, and 70, 80% of those orders issued in 1996 required that the record be released in 2006.
By
Had,
NARA.
by, yeah, NARA had to comply with these orders under the law. So they just should have automatically been released in 1996 because they were legal orders ordering them released. And when I, Paul Blow and I created a database, and when we reconciled the order with the actual related record, We found that most of them didn't comply with the order, and the records remained withheld into the 2020s instead of being released in 2006. So, I mean, it's demonstrable non-compliance with the ARB orders that we found.
So, okay, and the whole question is, where are all the rest of these final determination notices? What's really interesting about your article here, the work that you've done and the original research that you've done, is you have, I think, laid out a definitive case that those final determination forms should exist. They should have existed, right? So you talked to Jeremy Gunn, who was the chief counsel. Talk to Judge John Tunheim. Is it Tunheim or Tunheim? I want to get it right.
I think he says Tunheim.
All right, Tunheim. When you talk to them, Gunn told you via email that 100% of the final determination forms should be housed at NARA and available for inspection. Judge Tunheim told you that all the board's determinations were final determinations. And he said that if date-specific releases didn't happen, this was to the National Press Club in 2017, that someone hasn't pulled out the record. Well, gee, maybe the record wasn't there, turns out. Tom said he confirmed the 27,000 individual releases number. Go ahead.
Yeah, he has several times on numerous podcasts, and I think he even said it in his under oath testimony that they issued 27,000 final orders with regard to postponements. Now, you know, one of the, for me anyway, I think Mark would probably agree, one of the most interesting sections of the article were the interviews that I did with the senior ARB staff. And, you know, I got to say, they probably thought I was a little bit crazy because, like, I drilled down on into the weeds in great detail. You know, did you use staples or did you use paper clips?
Yeah.
What color were the file folders, right? And it seems insignificant, right? But what I really wanted to establish, like, just so it's undebatable, is that for every record, they created a file folder. And again, I'll go back to the way Mark describes it. For every individual assassination record, the ARRB had a file folder. It was like a court docket for a specific file. Their policies mandated that they handle and create each file. And Matt, you're a lawyer. You know how law firms' filing systems work. You know, you got Jeremy Gunn and a whole team of lawyers that are creating a process for declassification. You've got to do things systematically. So each file folder started with a RIF sheet or an identification aid. It had an unredacted copy of an assassination record. Then it had the redacted copy. Then it had the agency's requests for, like, their justification for the postponements. It had all of the ARB staff notes in these file folders. And once the review process and recommendations of the ARB staff had been made for each record, everything was put in this file folder, and it was put in a box to go to a board meeting so the board could vote on those records. Once the board voted on the record, everything was typed into their Lotus Note system that also tracked everything. And at the end of the meeting, they would print off all the final determination forms. And it was the staff's responsibility to take a printed copy of the final determination form, find the folder for the related file, and that final determination form would be literally attached with a clip to the as the cover new cover sheet of the inside of that file. And everything would be clipped so nothing could fall out of the file. And then it would be put in another archival box based on the meeting date in the agency, put back in the ARB SCIF so that it could be transmitted to NARA and entered back into the system with the final determination supposed to have governed. So I don't know, Mark, I've spoken too much on this. Our last trip to NARA on May 18th to 20th, Mark, you take it away on what we one of our main goals was to get these file folders. So I'm going to let
Yeah.
Mark take it from here because this
Well,
is a
yeah,
great
no,
story.
it's a perfect segue into Matt's question, like where else do you look for these, right? And not in any mislabeled box. I mean, you could get lucky again. So one of the chief goals on the recent visit was, yes, to locate the remaining final determination orders. Where they got to be there. As we just heard, the review board is on record that they were created and that they were filed away and transferred to NARA very systematically. So, Andrew came up with a really good idea that I quickly bought into about a month before we went to the National Archives. He's like, we need those review board's file folders that would have all of the work of the review board that led up to a final determination order. They were all physically attached together, just like Andrew said. And we're going to specifically ask for those. I mean, they have to be there, right? We know they were filed away and attached to the record. So we did an advanced pull request, which is your way to get organized before you go. They will pull up to 16 archival boxes for you and put them on a cart. And if you get through all your 16, somehow you can get 16 more. We were only there. I was there 2 full days, Andrew 3. But we were targeting the review. So I did a bunch of advanced pull requests for the review board's meetings. As Andrew just indicated, they had meetings where they issued these orders and the file folders could be there, or more final determinations. There was nothing in the review board's meeting files other than minutes. Like I do association law, so when a board meeting happens, there's some basic minutes: who attended, and they had breakfast, they had a lunch break, and they and
They
then
ordered
Jeremy
sandwiches from this
Gunn,
restaurant.
yeah, and then Jeremy Gunn would put in what they call the Sunshine Law memo. So when they had closed meetings, right, when they would actually make these decisions, there was no information at all. But there was no trace of any of the file folders. And so when we asked for six examples, some Ruben Efron records, the Lopez report, and some David Phillips HSCA testimony, we know that records that the board saw. We have Andrew can talk about the final determinations we do have on the Ruben Efron records. But we wanted to see the file folders and all the work that the board did. And we talked to two of the most senior members at the National Archives you can talk to, who actually sought us out to make sure we were comfortable in getting what we needed. And after a good amount of discussion on it and laying it out exactly as Andrew put it 5 minutes ago, after 3 days of being there, we came away empty-handed. So they were not able to locate these little, I call them mini court files, because the example, Matt, is going down to your clerk of court in the county where you live in Ohio and saying, there was this lawsuit last year. I want to see all the filings by the lawyers, all of the briefs, all of the motions, and I want to see the final judgment. What did the court rule? I want to read it all. And you go to your clerk of court and ask for it. And they send you away empty-handed and say, "But we don't have that." Oh, well,
Yeah,
here's
we
the
can't find it. They
you
said
can't
they
find it.
couldn't
Here,
find it.
here's the case number, or here's the RIF number. In the case of the JFK records, we gave them the RIF numbers, and we want the review board's folder on that. And they looked at us like we had three heads.
What did you get the RIF number from? How did you know the RIF number in the first place?
Oh,
Yeah,
just for
so
some test cases.
for those, we asked for six original ARB file folders for six specific RIF numbers. I think four of them had to do with Ruben Efron. So we have the Ruben Efron assassination file, and it has a RIF number associated with it. And so we just asked for the original ARB file folder for those four Ruben Efrons and then the Lopez report ARB file folder for that record. Right.
Got it.
And that's why, again, going back to the article and the interviews, I was so meticulous in interviewing like Doug Horne and Chet Rhodes, Peter Voth, David Marwell, about how they created these files for this exact reason, right? Because I wanted to understand their granular process of putting together the file folder, what was inside the files. So we know they exist. And under the Act, those file folders themselves and their contents are all assassination records under the law. And by law, they're not allowed to be destroyed or compromised. They need to be preserved. So, and the ARB made sure of that. They wrote that in, and it's in the law. All ARB records are assassination records. So the fact that the National Archives can't find them is deeply problematic.
Yeah, yes, for sure. You interviewed a guy named Chet Rhodes, right? He was one of the an ARB staffer, a computer specialist, and he's kind of the guy that was running the Lotus Notes program. Is that right?
Yeah.
I was going to ask, Matt, what happened to the actual computer software? Does that still even exist? Like, does the National Archives have it, the Lotus, or what?
Yeah, Chet Rhodes was great. I talked to him for maybe an hour on the telephone. And he was one of the first employees hired by the ARB, by David Marwell, when he became executive director. And Chet and David Marwell really conceptualized how they wanted the system to run, to track it electronically on a computer system. So they used Lotus Notes, which is an old, it's an email-based program that also has a database and calendars all collaborating with each other on the software. And so he was there from the very beginning to the very end, Chet Rhodes. And at the end, he went into significant detail with me during the interview. He packaged up three full computer systems. Everything was on CD-ROM, and they packaged up the servers, hard drives, copies of everything. And then he took it over to the National Archives along with a memo on how the National Archives could keep the Lotus Notes system working. So God forbid the National Archives decided to do their job under the Act and comply with the ARB orders. And you know what? I've asked for information on the Lotus Notes system. It's funny, the Friday before we arrived at the archives on Monday, we got a bit of a dump by the National Archives at 8:30 and 9 o'clock at night on a Friday night. In anticipation of our visit. They were expecting us, it's pretty clear. And they gave me a bunch of raw data that it appears to have come from the Lotus Notes system. So maybe they found some of the CD-ROMs that that this stuff was on.
Yeah, they're probably just a box of floppies and it's like labeled Oregon Trail, but that's actually all the Lotus Notes for the whole thing. All right, I want to talk about something that's potentially uncomfortable, but maybe I'm just misunderstanding it too. And this is just me. Maybe I'm putting together things that shouldn't be put together, but this was my takeaway from the article. So you talk about how the final determination forms, the version from 1996, was very detailed, and it followed the statutory letter of the law. In your article, you do a really good job citing. You do a good job in many respects, Mark and Andrew, but you do a good job demonstrating what it actually looks like, and you break down all the little, you know, you sort of diagram all the different parts of it. But then, so 96, we're thorough, everything is following the statute, it's all good. But then you have one from 1998, and it's essentially, you say, it's like a blank document. And it's not totally blank, but there's it's bare bones, and they're clearly not complying with the statute in the 1998 version. So the question is, what happened between 1996 and 1998, and then a related possible answer for that is this conversation going on between Barry Harrelson of the CIA and David Marwell. And when we see these emails back and forth, and he's sort of grappling with like, hey, this is going to take forever if we do it the way that the law requires. Maybe we ought to just, maybe instead of working on classification by individual section and part, we should just do it whole documents. And we see that conversation. We don't see where that conversation ended, right? So we don't know what actually happened. But around the same time as when they're having that conversation, in fact, they stop following the final determination form. So maybe those two things aren't related, but it almost feels like, man, isn't that the way it always goes? It's like the bad guys get away because like pragmatically, like that was the easiest like route. Like it's like not conspiratorial. It is, but it's like, you know, it sort of dies in the dark, you know?
Anyway. You know, it's kind of sad. I'm so deep into the YARB final determinations that last year, I mean, I kind of noticed that there was an absence of any final determinations that I could find for 1997 and 1998. I've written about that in previous articles. And sometime last year, I had a sneaking feeling that they must have changed their policy just because I haven't seen a 97 or 98 final determination. So I wrote Jeremy Gunn and Judge Thunheim, I don't know, maybe two or three times. And my question always was, did you guys change your policies in the spring of 1997 with regard to the final determinations? And this is before I saw the March 7, 1997 memo between David Marwell and Barry Harrelson that you're talking about. Something must have changed in the spring of 97. And when I found that March 1997 memo, I'm going, holy crap, this is clearly they changed their policies. And so once I found that memo, the first thing I did is I copied it, I scanned it, and I sent it off to David Marwell and Judge Thunheim and Jeremy Gunn. And I'm like, what happened, right? And I haven't heard from them since, so I don't know what happened. And I think I emailed them in May or June of 2025. That's the last time I've tried corresponding. I haven't heard back from any of them. I don't know what happened to the 97 and 98 final determinations. If they were all issued like blank pieces of paper, like that example, I found four or five from 98, and they're all like that one. They're all virtually blank pieces of paper. No orders, no release dates, no periodic review dates, no Section 6 justification for reasons. It's kind of disturbing. It's disappointing, in fact, if the ARB did change their policies and stopped following what we think the law required, which was a Section 6 justification and a date for release or periodic review, then that's a real problem with the way the ARB finished their job. We know that they were seriously under the clock to get a massive amount of records that were being stalled by several agencies in terms of the agency's reviews. But I do have a sneaking feeling that they stopped issuing substantive final determinations in the spring of 1997. And that's my main reason for going to the National Archives this time, to see if I could find any internal documentation to show that there was a board meeting where they made that decision to streamline the final determination process.
But if they made that decision, doing so would be a blatant violation of the statute, would it not?
I would have to see the policy change to see what it said. But the final determinations that I've seen are problematic in my view, because they don't, like, just by administrative law principles, you have to give adequate reasons to justify your final agency action on an issue. And without any meaningful Section 6 justification and no release or review dates, it would kind of fail on that fundamental requirement for issuing an agency final action. That you guys are American attorneys. I'm just a lowly Canadian in-house counsel, but I think it's the same principles.
The bright side, let's just assume that all or a huge portion of the later issued 97 and 98 final determination. Let's just say they did have that different and less than sufficient format that they still have to be located because they would identify the record that the board made a decision on. And let's face it, the end date was 2017 anyways for a mandated release under the JFK Act, unless the president, said otherwise. So they still need to be located, so that they are accounted for, and those record and the status of the assassination records that were attached to them are accounted for.
Let me ask you. Sorry,
But
go ahead.
since we've only found and located less than 2% of the final determinations, we're just shooting in the dark here. I mean, we have to find copies of those legal orders, and then we can see what the status of the records are, right?
So I just a couple more things here, and then we'll wrap up. I guess one big question is obviously the Mary Farrell litigation is wrapped up. Where do you see the future of the JFK Records Act in court, if at all? I mean, because there's two issues. There's can we get the law to do the thing it's supposed to do? That's issue number one. Issue number two is if we can, where's the stuff? And if we get the judgment, will we be able to go find it, or will it just become an administrative error? You know what I mean? Like those are really the two different issues as I see it. But you guys know way more than me about it. What do you view? How do you view that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly see the issue of the final determinations as being like a viable legal issue to resolve, A, getting them, and B, if they haven't been complied with, having them enforced. So I think that's fair game. But as for other litigation, I don't know. I mean, my focus has been on the final determinations, and I don't know whether Mark has any comment about potential litigation.
Yeah, I mean we've kicked it around for sure, other claims that could be brought, but we started shifting our recent focus to oversight as the most practical solution at this point in time. And we in our article we write, about an alternate universe, and if the first thing that the task force had taken on after Trump's order came out would have been calling the archivists and starting the oversight process on all of the assassination records. Yes, it's been awesome that some additional records have been located by the task force. The hearings were fantastic. They got a lot of things on the record that folks that are just learning about this case had never heard before. Dan Hardway and Doug Horn and Judge Thunheim and Jeff Morley and Jim and Oliver. And you guys were had the pleasure of seeing the first one. It was awesome. So, but if oversight takes it on, they have never-ending jurisdiction under the JFK Act over all the issues we're talking about here today. And if that ball can get rolling, the final report of the task force will be issued by November, and we're sincerely hoping that the oversight pieces that both the Senate and the House can rightfully take control of. And so, it would be more effective than litigation. The statute's still on the books. The Archivist of the United States cannot certify, as required by the act, that everything has been made public until there's a true inventory of the entire collection, both what the review board did, and that ties into the final determinations, and everything that circumvented the review board, as we talked about at the beginning of the show here. So that's what I'd like to see.
Well, speaking of the congressional task force, I understand you guys, do you have some news regarding that?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Oh, yeah. So, we hope that, and we're trusting that a good result of writing this article and really drilling down on this issues. We've recently been invited to meet with Representative Luna in Washington on June 10th. We'll be going up there in a little over a week and presenting some of these issues and findings and the oversight pieces that I just mentioned. So that's we're excited about it.
So by the
Yeah,
time
for
this is
sure.
out, you guys will have met with Congresswoman Luna. All right.
Yeah, we're hoping the meeting goes well. We're going in trying to put as strong a case forward for there to be actual oversight of the JFK records collection. I mean, we're focused on really not the final determinations. That's a small piece of what we think is important, and we keep hammering home the need for there to be a full inventory and index of all of the records in the collection, all three tranches, the pre-JFK Act records that were sent in error, like all the Warren Commission and HSCA and Church Committee records that were sent over there, and then all of the records that are covered by the final determinations under the ARB review. But really, the black hole of all black holes is what was shipped over to NARA after the ARB wrapped up its operations in September of 1998. We don't know what was put in, when it was put in, how much was put in of these records, and that to us, there has to be a full inventory and a status report on each record. Each one of those requires a RIF number, so we need to know what's there before we can even start to think any certification by the archivist that the act is being fulfilled and all the records are being released. We need an inventory. It's like a simple accounting, and that's where Jeff Crudell really comes in. He has a background on auditing and accounting institutions, and that was the first thing he identified. He said we need to do an inventory, and it needs to be done thoroughly. And so we've really kind of hopped on that train
Good.
and looked specifically at what the act requires. So when we go and speak with Representative Luna, that's really going to be our focus.
Good. Well, I know in your article you laid out 10 points that you thought were vital, your 10-point roadmap. So it was funny. I was excited reading your roadmap. I'm going to read through it right now because it got me so fired up, but I got so fired up reading your roadmap. I felt like I was like reading like some sort of like motivational speech. And it was almost, it brought to me
You're
like,
going too far, I can tell.
no, it brought the energy of like when LBJ was talking to Richard Russell, trying to tell him to be on the, to convince him to be on the Warren Commission. And he was like, well, you fought in the military. You put your uniform on and you fight for your country, bad as you are. I was like, you know what? This makes me want to put my uniform on and fight for the JFK assassination research community, fat as I am. And so anyway, here's the top 10. Number one, release the ARRB final determination orders to the extent they exist, or tell us what the hell happened to them. Number two, release all ARRB records, including the Lotus Notes database. Three, publish a full subject guidebook and index to the entire collection. Four, remove special sealing rules for the Church, Schweikert, Hart, and HSCA records. Number five, pursue the missing Bethesda autopsy records, kind of important. Number six, require the Department of Defense and military intelligence to release all assassination records. Seven and eight, question past and present archivists and National Archives JFK staff under oath on non-compliance with release orders and post-1998 transfers. That would be awesome too. There's still a little bit of the whole Alan Dulles, well, do you think they're going to tell the truth type situation? But maybe they will. I don't know. Number nine, release all internal NARA records, including legal opinions on the JFK Records Act. And number 10, appoint a new ARRB for final decisions on postponed unreviewed records, i.e., pretend that you care about the law. That's what we want. We want a law with teeth, right? If we're going to have a law, then let's have a law, right? So there you go. I think that's a great list of things to get, and I understand that the task force is people have a lot of different opinions, but I still view it as something's better than nothing, And man, I'll tell you what, if you guys can get some of the things on your list, that would be awesome. And I think it's great that they're talking to you guys. That's certainly a positive sign. And then in terms of people finding your work, your three-part series is available at kennedysandking.com. And we've only touched on parts of it today, but I mean, for anybody who wants to see the inner workings of the ARRB, the third part of your article, I think, really showed sort of the real possibility of like innocent shenanigans. In other words, like what I mean by that is somebody trying to help, maybe not trying to have a nefarious ends, but it does seem like they're just like, oh, we can't process all this information at one time. Let's just not follow the thing. But maybe that's not what happened. I don't know. Anyway, it's fascinating. You guys have done amazing work on this, and there's nobody else that's as deep in the case, as deep on the JFK Records Act, as you two. So I'm honored to know you, and I appreciate you coming on and blessing us with your knowledge. Mark, anything else you want to add?
No, Matt, this was awesome. I mean, we've all done great work together in the past, and your show is just the gold standard. And I know you're going to come back guns a blazing in November with those very important topics you mentioned at the beginning, and just to have us on to share the latest on the records, and hopefully keep people interested in that. Everything helps that we're all doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you. When I come back, I'm going to wear a size medium uniform with the buttons. And that'll be my inside joke. That's how I know I have actually five people still in with the joke. But anyway, thanks guys. And Solving JFK listeners, appreciate the opportunity you've given me to do this. And gonna keep going, and we'll be back in November, ready to roll. Talk to y'all next time.